Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So we are finishing the 10th canto this morning, page 384, final two chapters. And before we start, I would like to say how much I appreciate you allowing me to read this book with you. I was very appreciative of the chance to go through, find the mistakes, just to have the experience of reading it. And I hope it was tolerable for you. This was, like we saw yesterday, you know, there's a great deal of information in every chapter that we're just kind of skimming through. And you could take any one of these verses and spend an hour on it very easily, and many hours in many cases. So this is the experience of getting a very quick overview of all of these pastimes of Krishna. And that has been our strategy and our approach to the semester, and or for this section, rather. So this is the final few pastimes of Krishna in this chapter, followed by a kind of an ecstatic monologue by Shukadeva at the end. After finishing the whole narration of Krishna's Leela, he's not finished with the whole Bhagavatam, but he is finished with this portion. And he is he ends it with this very dramatic and enthusiastic expression of appreciation. So, chapter 30, Vishnu. Shiva's devotees wealthier? Said Vishnurata, why are Krishna's devotees so poor? Lord Shiva's devotees, in general, seem to own much more. Since Krishna is much wealthier than Shiva, I suspect, this fact seems just the opposite of what one would expect. Lord Shiva interacts with matter. That is his domain. Appeasing Shiva makes objectives easy to obtain. Lord Krishna, on the other hand, transcends the mundane realm. His devotees, like him, are pure and never overwhelmed. Your grandfather, King Yudhisthira, once raised this paradox directly to Lord Krishna, who responded with these thoughts. When someone truly pleases me, I pilfer all his wealth. His relatives and friends then leave this beggar to himself. Abandoned, sad, and thwarted, he befriends my devotees and quickly gains my mercy in exceptional degrees. Although I give enlightenment and freedom from distress, conditioned souls in general want to keep what they possess, so they appeal to gods who are much easier to please, though when they thrive, they sometimes try to kill their deities. Lord Shiva, Lord Brahma, and the Supreme Lord Vishnu all can elevate a person or create a person's fall. Unlike Lord Vishnu, Shiva and Brahma are quickly pleased, as wicked Vrika once confirmed by his activities. The story of Vrika. The demon Vrika met the saintly Narada one day and asked which god would fill his wish the most efficient way. Said Narada, if you ask nicely, Shiva won't take long, but he gets angry instantly if you do something wrong. So Vrika worshipped Shiva with a sick, bizarre device. He cut his flesh and burned it in the fire of sacrifice. A week went by. Impatient, Vrika dropped that plan. Instead, he washed his hair and bared his axe, prepared to cut his head. As Vrika poised to lop his head directly in the fire, Lord Shiva swiftly grabbed his arm and mercifully inquired, what is it that you want, my friend? Here, let me mend your wounds. Why, give your head. A cup of water's fine. I'll grant your boon. The crooked Vrika cackled as he gave this sick reply. When I touch someone's head, I wish that he at once shall die. Lord Shiva showed consent and gave his head a little shake, although he feared that he was giving nectar to a snake. To test Lord Shiva's blessing, Bricka raised his hand and said, I'd like, my lord, to see if this will work upon your head. Lord Shiva turned and, terrified, fled swiftly into space. The mystic Bricka ran behind and managed to keep pace. Since no one counteracts the boon that Shiva has bestowed, the gods could only stare as Shiva ran through their abode. At last he reached the Sea of Milk, that luminous domain inhabited by Vishnu, that the greatest souls attain. Lord Vishnu knew that Shiva had been threatened with demise and stepped in to protect him by assuming a disguise. Appearing 5 or 6 years old, with beads and deerskin dress, Lord Vishnu summoned Bricka, smiled, and pleasantly expressed, My dear respected sir, you've come so far. You must be tired. Please stop and rest your body, for your body is required for any great pursuit. That's good, relax. Now, if I'm fit, please tell me of your mission. I would love to hear of it. Lord Vishnu's words pleased Bricka, and the demon gladly stayed, explaining in complete detail his clever escapade. The youthful student listened well, then shook his head in doubt. In this case, said the student, we have something to find out. This Shiva, cursed by Daksha, gobbles flesh and ghostly haunts. He gives his fellow ghosts and goblins anything they want. His blessing must be useless. Quickly, touch your head and see, for if he lied, you must reply and end his treachery. Enchanted and bewildered by the student's artful words, the foolish Bricka touched his head. A piercing blast was heard as Bricka's head exploded. Then their voices joined as one. The gods cried out in admiration, Victory! Well done! As denizens of heaven showered flowers on the scene, Lord Vishnu said, Lord Shiva, Bricka's deeds were so obscene, he met a violent destiny. What else could he expect, offending you, a kindly guru, wise in all respects? Lord Krishna, Vishnu's origin, directly manifests the energies of matter, spirit, truth, and all the rest. A soul who hears or tells how Shiva's problem was dispelled shall overcome his enemies and birth and death as well. Bhrigu's quest. To show how Vishnu differs from Brahma and all the rest, I'll tell you of some Brahmins who performed a certain test. They sent the learned Bhrigu Muni to research and see, was Vishnu, Shiva, or Brahma the foremost deity? I'll see who is most tolerant, thought Bhrigu. To inspect, he went to Lord Brahma's abode, but failed to genuflect. Brahma became quite angry. But before he came undone, he managed to control himself, for Bhrigu was his son. To Mount Kailash went Bhrigu, where Lord Shiva domiciles. The sage was Shiva's brother. They'd not met in quite a while. When Shiva came to hug him, Bhrigu turned away and said, You're nothing but a deviant. His brother's eyes turned red. Lord Shiva raised his trident and was set to make a kill when Parvati, his wife, stepped in with diplomatic skill. Escaping to Vaikuntha, where Lord Vishnu lay at rest, the daring Bhrigu marched to him and kicked him in the chest. Arising from his bedstead with his lovely consort, Shri, Lord Vishnu bowed and said profoundly, Kindly pardon me. Your tender, sacred foot has made me purified and blessed. From now on, Shri, the queen of wealth, shall live upon my chest. This solemn speech left Bhrigu stunned. He couldn't say a word. Reactions to his first two tests were nothing like the third. His heart full of devotion for Lord Vishnu, he returned and told his fellow Brahmins what he positively learned. Dear friends, there are offenses of the body, speech, and mind. I tested these three lords with a transgression of each kind. Lord Vishnu was so gracious that he accepted my offense as if it were an offering. The others were incensed. Amazed and swayed, the Brahmins prayed, Lord Vishnu is the source of courage, peace, religion, wisdom, truth, and mystic force. These saints of keen intelligence adore him selflessly without a secret motive to enjoy his energies. Though Vishnu pardoned Bhrigu and the Brahmins, ever since the Brahmins gain but poverty from Shri for their offense. The Brahmins' sons saved. Another time, Lord Krishna and Arjuna went to see Lord Vishnu in his own abode. Now, listen carefully, for walking on this worldly path reduces us to tears unless the fragrant nectar of Lord Krishna fills our ears. In Dwarka, a Brahmin's wife once bore a baby son, who died before he touched the earth. The father, deeply stunned, laid out the corpse upon King Ugrasen's palatial stairs. Lamenting and distraught, the Brahmin said in great despair, "This greedy, lying king has ruled this kingdom with such fault my blameless newborn son has passed away as a result. The subjects of this violent, self-indulgent monarchy are doomed to suffer poverty and constant misery." The Brahmin lost his second son, and then again his third. He laid the blame on Ugrasen each time that this occurred. The ninth time, Krishna and Arjuna nearby overheard. Distressed, Arjuna then addressed the father with these words, "Will not one single royal warrior stand and guard your door? Why do your so-called rulers leave you wretched and ignored? A kingdom in which Brahmins lose their children, wealth, or wives is ruled by mere impostors, leading sedentary lives. Dear Brahmin, I won't tolerate a loss so grim and dire. I vow to save your children, or I swear I'll enter fire." The Brahmin said, "What Balaram and Krishna couldn't do is far beyond your powers. Why on earth should I trust you?" Arjuna Grave said firmly, "You are partially correct. I'm neither Balaram nor Krishna. Still, I will protect your future children from their brother's strange fatalities. You'll come to know my powers. Even Shiva has been pleased." The Brahmin became reassured and went home satisfied. Returning to Arjuna, when the next child came, he cried, "Please save my child from death." Arjuna, fast as he could go, said prayers to Shiva, chanted hymns, and strung his famous bow. Arjuna rushed directly to the cottage of the sage, surrounding it with mystic arrows, structured as a cage. The Brahmin's wife delivered a fine boy who cooed and cried, yet after a few minutes, he just vanished in the sky. The Brahmin wept and told Arjuna, "I was so unwise to trust a bragging eunuch in a warrior's disguise. God damn your lies, Arjuna, and your weapons and your fame. You said this child would stay, but now his fate is just the same." Arjuna didn't hear these words, for he was occupied traversing to the planet where the Lord of Death resides. The infant wasn't there, nor up in heaven, nor in hell. Arjuna, with the case unsolved, resolved to kill himself. Arjuna, planning suicide, stopped short when Krishna said, "I'll take you to those boys. It's not your fault that they are dead. These men who criticize you now will shortly sing your praise. Now join me in my chariot." With that, they rode away. They traveled through the universe and then its outer shell. When all turned dark, the horses balked, for they could not see well. The master of all kinds of mystics, Krishna, tossed his disc, which lit the scene around the team with perfect vividness. Like one of Ramachandra's arrows, Krishna's disc shot through the inky ignorance with which this cosmos is imbued. Beyond that realm of darkness lay the spiritual sky. Its shining outskirts made Arjuna blind. He shut his eyes. Beyond that bright, effulgent light, Arjuna saw a sea endowed with giant windswept waves that churned resplendently. A gorgeous palace rose above the waves, its charm enhanced by countless jeweled pillars. How Arjuna was entranced. The mammoth serpent Shesha lay upon his back within, his thousands of enormous hoods lit up by shining gems. His massive body, wider than a mountain clad with snow, set off his necks and hissing tongues of blue and indigo. Lord Mahavishnu lay upon the serpent's underside, attendant by his many energies personified. A brilliant yellow robe adorned his skin of rain cloud blue. His hair reflected radiance that graced his crown and jewels. Of all his gems, Kaustubha, midst his garlands, was the best. The famous mark, Sri Vatsa, showed quite clearly on his chest. Lord Krishna bowed his head to this expansion of himself. Arjuna, quite astonished at the sight, bowed down as well. Lord Mahavishnu, our creator, smiled majestically and stared and stated in a solemn voice of great authority, "I brought the Brahmin sons here to induce you both to come. Though you are Nara and Narayan, lately you've become engaged in killing demons. By your work, the earth is free. Continue your religious deeds, they're most exemplary." Though Mahavishnu always stays in Krishna's full control, he gave commands to Krishna as an actor plays a role. Because Arjuna thought Lord Vishnu senior to his friend, the Lord spoke so Arjuna could directly comprehend. Instructed by Lord Vishnu, Krishna and Arjuna bowed and took the 10 still infant sons past ocean, space, and clouds back to their joyful parents. Still Arjuna was amazed. Still Arjuna, quite amazed, thought, "Why would Mahavishnu call for Krishna in that way?" Chapter 31, Krishna. Krishna's family. In Dwarka, Lord Krishna and his 16,000 wives enjoyed with all the citizens divinely lavish lives, while Calvary, bedecked in gold, patrolled attractive streets. The cuckoos, bees, and larks used landscape parks as their retreats. Parading giant elephants enjoyed a jubilee. Each one of Krishna's wives saw him as private property. In 16,000 palace grounds, they frolicked in clear ponds, embracing amid lotus flowers, cooing birds, and swans. While singers sang and drummers drummed and bards recited verse, the Lord's wives filled syringes and pushed out incessant squirts. They doused the Lord, and he doused them in blissful spousal sport while laughing and enjoying life like gods in Indra's court. Their saris drenched, their royal breasts and thighs shone in relief. The queens brushed back their slackened braids, and swift as any thief would try to steal the Lord's syringe with clever thrusts and fakes, yet always somehow wound up smiling in his warm embrace. Lord Krishna so enjoyed this play, hair scattered on his head, he pressed his garland to his spouse's breasts and turned it red. Repeatedly he sprayed his wives as they sprayed him in turn, like elephants might play in jungle lakes without concern. When all this fun was over, they went in to change their dress and brought their moistened silks and precious gems to give their guests. In this way, Krishna spent his days and played the husband's part. With glances, smiles, and laughter, he enthralled his consorts' hearts. Lord Krishna's queens, unstable in their bliss with him, appeared to go insane. In ecstasy, they spoke like this, please hear. The Queen's Ecstasy. "Dear cranes and ospreys, it is night, but instead of sleeping, you're wide awake. Is it because in your heart you're keeping Lord Krishna's smiling, playful glance? There is no denying, like us, you're hankering for Krishna. We hear you crying. Dear ocean, are you also sleepless? We hear you roaring. Are you the sea of milk, and hopeless of now restoring the famed Kaustubha gem and Lakshmi of blessed endeavor, whom Krishna took from you and keeps on his chest forever? Dear moon, you're dim. Are you diseased, sore? Are you diseased or, like us, forgetful of promises that Krishna gave you when you were fretful? Dear breeze, are you displeased? We feel how your touch enhances our lusty hearts already struck by Govinda's glances. Dear cloud, we see that you love Krishna, for you protect him from scorching sunlight and the sunburn that might affect him. Like us, you crave him, as your teardrops are now expressing. Associating with this Krishna is so depressing. Dear cuckoo, how your song reminds us of Krishna speaking. We wish to serve you, friend. Is there anything you're seeking? Dear silent mountain peaks, like us, do you wish to be blessed by Krishna's footprints falling softly upon your raised breasts? Dear rivers, you have grown so dry. What has made you shrivel? Have you become attached to Krishna, who's so uncivil? He now withholds those loving looks that you found endearing? No wonder all your lotus flowers are disappearing. Dear swan, please sit and drink some milk. We know Krishna sent you. Did he forget what he told us, or does he pretend to? Tell him to come to us and show some reciprocation and leave behind the Queen of Fortune for this occasion. The simple act of speaking these ecstatic, loving thoughts allowed Lord Krishna's wives to thus revive their love of God. If hearing of Lord Krishna can make someone feel this way, imagine how his wives loved him. They saw him every day. Lord Krishna's family. Lord Krishna, as a householder, performed the proper rites to show the perfect mix of wealth, religion, and delight. Not only did he show us how to lead religious lives, he did so after gathering some 16,000 wives. The absolute Lord Krishna, whose endeavor never fails, begot in every single wife 1 female and 10 males. Lord Krishna's kindred thus expanded exponentially. The leading son, Pradyumna, was his child by Rukmini. Pradyumna's son was Aniruddha, who would sire in time a son named Bhadra, who in turn preserved the family line. The countless Yadu offspring never suffered from ill health, distaste for being spiritual, or lack of sons or wealth. King Ugrasen brought countless teachers in to educate and servants too, in quantities too large to calculate. As demons born as humans sullied earth with their demands, Lord Krishna stopped them with the help of gods born in his clan. The Yadus gave Lord Krishna their unbounded loyalty. His closest friends especially enjoyed prosperity. While having talks or taking walks or sitting to refresh, they thought of Krishna always, undistracted by their flesh. Blessings. As we now are coming to the end of this long narration, let me offer Krishna my respectful appreciation. Formerly, the Ganges was the first place of veneration. Now it is the Yadu dynasty, Krishna's own relations. Enemy or friend, to see Lord Krishna provide salvation. Lakshmi stays with him, although she's mankind's infatuation. Every truth has Krishna as its source and its sole foundation. For simply saying Krishna will destroy one's contamination. Wielding as he does the disk of time with its sharp gyrations, only Krishna rescues Mother Earth in her desperation. That he is the son of Devaki is no limitation. Krishna dwells in every living being throughout creation. Krishna's very presence brings all sins to annihilation. Krishna's smile imbues the gopis' hearts with anticipation. Krishna conquers others too in various incarnations. May you ever hear of Krishna's deeds as your meditation. May he ever stay with you in glorious jubilation. By hearing and repeating and reflecting on my words, the matchless deeds of Krishna stated just as they occurred, you'll surely grow more fascinated, faithful, and sincere, and soon move on to Krishna's world, where death invokes no fear. For Krishna, many souls, both rich and poor, like you and me, have overthrown the lives they've known to dance in ecstasy.
This book, because it helped me a lot to get prepared for this class, and I wanted to share what he had to say about it. And the first story was about Shiva, and why his devotees seem to be wealthier than the devotees of Krishna, like us. And I wanted to start with a quote from the Bhagavad Gita. Oh, sorry. Is that my sister? Oh, okay. And the Bhagavad Gita, it says, those who worship the different demigods achieve the desired results, the respective demigods can reward. Similarly, those who worship the material energy receive a suitable reward for such activities, and those who worship the pitras receive similar results. But those who engage in devotional service or worship the Supreme Lord Vishnu or Krishna go to the Vaikuntha planets or Krishna Loka. So, Shiva is the master of the material energy through Durga, his consort, and his devotees are affected by the three material modes of nature. And Shiva is not, though. A lot of people think that he is bound by the material modes of nature, and I guess that was my understanding, but he's not. He represents the mode of ignorance, but he's not bound by it. Krishna says that we need to transcend the three modes, so that's why we shouldn't really offer any reverence to the demigods, because then we'll, instead of attaining liberation, we're just going to get more attachments, because they'll give us more material opulences instead of spiritual opulences, which we receive through Krishna. And so it's not actually advancement, but it's degradation. And he's opulent in material wealth, but not spiritual wealth. And Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita that Nishray Gunya Bhavar Juna, the mission of human life is to become transcendental to the three qualities. So one needs to become free of material entanglement. And by worshiping Krishna, one becomes enriched with spiritual advancement of knowledge and Krishna consciousness. And we can gradually become Nirguna, which means to achieve eternal peace, fearlessness, religiousness, knowledge, and renunciation. And this can only be done if we follow the instructions of the Supreme Lord. Okay, and I wanted to stress the difference between a karmi and a devotee that is explained in the book. And it says that if Krishna says that if I especially favor a devotee and especially wish to care for him, the first thing I do is take away his riches. So we're all very favorable. But the only reason why he does this is to make his devotee completely attached to him. Because if you have nothing, who else are you going to turn to? After everybody leaves you and everybody thinks that you're just a loser, the only thing you have left is Krishna. So he does this to make sure that you become attached to him and not to anything else. And there is a prayer of Queen Kunti that's really sweet. And she says, "My dear Krishna, in our distress you were always present with us. I would therefore prefer to live in distress than to lose you." And I thought that was really sweet, because it's she's willing to suffer so much just to remember Krishna, and we're always so worried about not suffering. At least I am always wondering why I'm suffering and wondering why all these problems arise. But then it's you realize that it's Krishna's mercy, and that the only reason why you're going through all of this is to make your spiritual life stronger. Okay, so about the story of Vrikasura, Narada knew the nature of the demon and told him not to worship Vishnu or Brahma, because they knew that he wasn't going to be able to. He knew he wasn't going to be able to stick with Vishnu because he was in the mode of ignorance, and people in the mode of ignorance can't worship Vishnu. So he told him to worship Shiva because he's easily pleased. It said that the Shiva lingams are worshipped with bathing of the Ganges water, and that's all that Shiva ever wanted, was just a glass of water. And he stresses that. He's like, "You don't need to cut your head or offer me your flesh, just a little bit of water would have done." And So one difference that they made in the Krishna book is about the difference between a demon and a devotee. And the devotee is akama, without desire, while a demon is sarvakama, which is that it has a desire for everything. So the devotee is confident when he's worshiping Krishna that Krishna will accept any of his offerings. And Krishna says it throughout the scriptures that if you offer anything with love and reverence, I'll accept anything. A leaf and a flower. But that demons, they want to actually see the deity, and they want him to, like, they want the deity to appear in front of them so they can ask for benedictions and get something back. Like, the whole purpose of offering for them is to get something, which is not what we do, at least what we shouldn't be doing. And the only reason that Shiva came to him was because he felt compassion for him, not because he was about to chop his head off and, like, offer all of these, like, respect to Shiva, but it was more of a compassion because he was about to commit suicide. So he came and he told him, like, oh, please don't kill yourself. Like, I'll do anything. I'll give you any benediction that you want. And he didn't know, like, what kind of demon he was. And then he felt really bad afterwards. He felt sorry for saying that he would have granted any benediction. And it says that after he gave the benediction to Vikrasura, that Vikrasura wanted to kill Shiva and take Parvati for his own enjoyment. And when Vishnu showed up, or Krishna showed up as the Brahman, he addressed Vikrasura as the son of Shakyamuni, just so, like, he would have some trust in him and, like, have that little relationship with him so he could be like, oh yeah, let me trust you and touch my own head, you know, and explode. So after Vikrasura died, Vishnu told Shiva, my dear Lord, a person who commits an offense to great souls cannot continue to exist. He is vanquished by his own sinful activities. So you see this, like, everyday life. How many people die just because they keep doing the same things over and over again? Like, somebody who drives drunk, you know what I mean? Like, they've obviously done it before, and they know it's wrong, and they keep doing it. So eventually it's going to kill you. So I thought that was a good point. Okay. So from Bhrigu's quest, I kind of picked out, like, the most important things from the story. So the sages wanted to find out who had the quality of goodness between Lord Brahma, Lord Vishnu, and Lord Shiva. And they found out that Lord Brahma had passion but could still control it. And Lord Shiva had ignorance, but it was controlled by his goodness that was brought out through Parvati. And then that Lord Vishnu was controlled by goodness, or controlled goodness. And the only reason why Vishnu didn't get mad was because he was trying to set an example that Brahmins should always be excused if he commits an offense. And he's all merciful, so he knew that, like, the Brahmin was committing an offense, but he still took it as an offering and set an example to the Brahmin and was, like, very humble. And that just goes to show, like, how good he is and how merciful. And there's the three offenses, the mind, speech, and body. The worst being the body, and then the speech, and then your mind. And I heard that in Kali Yuga, you're not responsible for the things that you think, which is good. I think so. Anyway, so I like this one part that they said in the book, that Lord Shiva and Brahma lost their peace when offended. So how can they offer peace to their devotees? So it's like, we see Krishna, he's always so happy, and he's never, like, angry at anybody, and he goes around killing demons and stuff, but it's, the whole purpose is to protect us, you know, and to protect his devotees and to show us how we're supposed to act and how we're supposed to maintain a good relationship with him, and not, like, I feel like the demigods are angry, like Kali and Shiva, they're always, like, scary and stuff, and you never see them smiling. I don't know. I just feel a lot more attracted to somebody who's, like, going around playing the flute than juggling heads, you know? It also says that one's greatness has to be estimated by one's ability to tolerate provoking situations. So you can see how great Vishnu was by being kicked and not even, like, getting mad. On the contrary, like, feeling like it was a blessing, you know? That was really nice. And it says that Supreme Self and the individual self, although one in quality, are different in quantity. And this analytical understanding of knowledge is perfect. Simply to understand I am not matter, I am spirit, is not perfect knowledge. The real religious principle is devotional service or bhakti, like it's said in the Bhagavad Gita. And then once Lord Chaitanya asked one of his devotees, Ramananda Raya, what is the greatest fame? And he replied that the greatest fame is to be known as a pure devotee of Lord Krishna. So, like, I think that's really nice because sometimes, like, going to school and stuff and serving Krishna lunch and being, like, so out there for everybody to see, at the beginning it was hard and it was kind of, like, embarrassing, I guess. And now it's, like, not so much. Like, it's really empowered me to go to school wearing tilak, and I think it's really nice to read this, that the best way to be known is to be known as a Vaishnava. We should strive to be akinchana, which is to be satisfied under any condition. Even after one becomes a stage of seeing, after one comes to a stage of seeing every living entity as part and parcel of God, you can actually become satisfied in any condition. Because no matter what, you'll be remembering Krishna, and you'll be surrounded by Krishna and his love. And then all the sages engaged in devotional service and went back to Godhead. Let's go kick Vishnu. I'm just kidding. Anyway. One thing I wanted to say about Arjuna was that he took shelter of Shiva instead of taking shelter of Krishna, who was his friend, just because Shiva gave him, like, a bow. Or the arrow, was it? I think it was Pashupata? Yeah. So he was, like, thankful to Shiva for the arrow, and he was, like, taking shelter of him instead of thinking, like, oh, Krishna, my friend, the Almighty Supreme Lord. You know, so that way he wasn't able to take care of the baby, and it just, like, went away. And then after he started, after he came with Krishna, his problems were solved. Like, he was able to find the baby's things through Krishna, and then understood that Krishna is actually the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and that he should have always taken shelter of him and not of the demigods. And then it said that Mahavishnu is a feature. His feature is an expansion of Krishna's body. And that Brahma Samhita is Mahavishnu, which is his portion of planetary expansion. Is that right? Very cool. That's really confusing to read. I don't quite understand it, so it's kind of hard to get across on it. Anyway, so about Krishna and Krishna's family. One thing that the impersonalists don't believe is that there is some kind of enjoyment in the spiritual world. So we're reading all these pastimes of Krishna that take place in the spiritual planets, and we can thrive for these because it's like we enjoy here, but it's only like a perverted reflection of the enjoyment that we can have there. And there's so many like different types of enjoyments, and Krishna comes here to prove that that the impersonalists are wrong, thinking that there's no enjoyment there. And he shows that there's pleasurable facilities of life. And that the spiritual world, the pastimes are eternal and they're never ending. While here in the material world, they're impermanent and perverted. Anyway. So any devotee who takes Krishna with his heart, who loves Krishna with his heart and soul, Krishna reciprocates in such a way that the devotee cannot but remain attached to him. So like if you love Krishna sincerely, you'll eventually go back to where he is and where we're supposed to be. And the only type of attachment that he wants us to have is attachment to him. And in the Bhagavad Gita, it says, Parichanaya sadunam vinasaya cha dukshkritam. The Lord comes to protect the devotees and annihilate the miscreants. So some demigods were asked to descend as well, and Krishna came with his eternal servitors. And he comes because he's merciful and becomes to get us out of here. Essentially, Like, he knows we're suffering. We all know we're suffering. And we hear about his pastimes and about the spiritual world, and he wants us to go back. And before his appearance in the Yadu dynasty, the Ganges was the purest of all things in this world. And after he came, by his association with the Yadu dynasty, they became the purest way of becoming pure. Like, the easiest and most purifying thing was to come into contact with these people. They're out of the five characteristics of Krishna. One is that they become more effective in purifying others. He is more effective in purifying others. Two is that the devotees and the demons achieve the same result. So Krishna comes to protect us and kill the demons, but we both achieve the same result, or will achieve the same result, hopefully. The demons go back to the spiritual world, not necessarily where he is, but they're still there. And he protects the gopis, for example, and they stay in their form while the demons are just killed and like gone to the spiritual world. And one of the main things in the book that they stress a lot is the Maha Mantra. It's written four times in the last two pages of this book. And yeah, like all spelled out. Not even just like Maha Mantra, it's like the whole Maha Mantra is written. So they say that by surrendering unto him, one can discharge the principles of religious rites. And the glories of his holy name are more powerful than Vishnu and Brahm's names. And his holy name is mercy. Like, Lord Chaitanya came to give us his holy name just because he knew that we weren't like capable of doing anything else. All these like yoga paths and all these like austerities and different things one can do to achieve the same results. Like, somebody asked me yesterday, like, why is it that Lord Chaitanya came and gave us the Maha Mantra if in the Bhagavad Gita it says that if by doing all these yoga processes we can achieve that? And I asked him, I'm like, do you meditate? And he was like, yeah. And I'm like, how long does it take you to get into that meditation and stuff? And like, how often are you able to do it? And he told me it wasn't really that often. And I told him that for me, meditation doesn't work. And I'm not as capable as he is to like go into meditation, so I go for the Maha Mantra, which is easy, and I'll get the same result if I'm sincere about it. And yeah. So it also says that we should actually. Sukadeva Goswami says at the beginning of the Srimad Bhagavatam that it's extremely conducive to liberation, to listen to the pastimes of Krishna and to listen to Bhagavatam daily. And we achieve love of God through listening to his pastimes. And there's just so many different personalities in these pastimes and so many examples of how we should lead our lives and how we should always care for Krishna more than anything else and how he's so merciful and he's always there to take care of us and for us to take shelter under his lotus feet. Everything is there, we just need to like get it, you know, and sometimes it's hard to just like think that way, at least it is for me, to just leave everything behind and like just think of Krishna all the time. Anyway, I think that was it. Oh yeah, and Krishna is called Hrishikesha, which means the master of the senses, but we should strive to engage all of our senses in his service, and that way our senses won't be our enemies, but they'll be our friends. They'll be a tool for devotional service. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, now, everybody has now given a class this last month. Thank you very much, Andrea. With three exceptions. Okay. So Terry's managed to get a rain check until the fall. But I did want to ask Vaikuntha Lila and Andres if you'd be willing to do a class on Friday next week. I think by then, by Friday, is Friday a good day for you or Thursday? Okay, we'll have to see if I can rearrange our speaker on Thursday. Otherwise, we'll have to take another rain check. But how about you, Andres? Friday, is that okay? So, did you say eating or making? Wow. Okay. Well, that earns you a pass. Okay, so let me know, all right? See if you can work. Anyone like to do that? The topic would be my favorite part of Srimad Bhagavatam. Any section that you want to pick. That's what everyone else will be addressing next week. Okay, could you hold that question just a moment? I did want to ask Jagannath Puri down from it. Would you like to give a class next week? Okay. That's a resounding positive answer. Yes. Meter, yeah, the original Sanskrit changes meter from time to time throughout the course of the Bhagavatam. And it has some literary implications because somebody will be speaking and they'll all of a sudden start speaking in a different meter. So the primary meter is this iambic septameter, which is a very common da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. But then here at the last page, for example, this is a meter which is used only once, I believe. Da 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 da. That's on page 394. Like Dravida Prabhu said yesterday, right? When the personified Vedas began speaking to Mahavishnu, he discovered that before creation there was jazz. Sorry, sing? Well, they're written in that meter. Can you sing it? Well, I won't sing it, but I'll repeat it. Well, rhythm is part of music. Could it be sung? They don't sing very well, but they're written in that meter anyway. Yes, Derek? Right. That's what he was saying, because this all happened in Dwarka, and Balaram and Krishna lived there. Ugrasen, though, was the king. So, yes. Yes. They weren't able to protect him. They were the Kshatriyas, the leaders of the kingdom. They were all always fighting off enemies and killing miscreants. But the Brahmin complained. No. Let's discuss this a little bit, shall we? Because it seems very strange. Why would the Brahmin hold the king responsible? That's basically your question. This, as we read not too long ago, the king's responsibility is to always perform sacrifice, to be completely pure, transparent, just like our modern politicians. You know, they are thus representatives of God on earth. See, their business is only doing the highest good for the people. So if something is wrong, the implication is that the king is not doing his duty properly. Not that the king is God and can control everything, but if the king were worshiping God properly, then everything would be auspicious. And when something goes awry, that immediately implies the king has got some ulterior motive or is neglecting his duties. So this was the Brahmins, especially for the Brahmin, the priestly class. For something to go wrong for them is extremely inauspicious and inappropriate. So this is the benefit of a God-conscious kingdom, that God works through the leadership and manifests the kingdom of God on earth. Well, have you ever been in a situation where you said to someone, I'll do whatever you want, and then immediately they start looking at you and rubbing their hands, and you regret it, you know? So this is what happened with Lord Shiva. Okay, I'll give you any boon you want. And then he immediately regretted it. What is the consciousness of this person who's so tamasic? He's going to put his own flesh in the fire. So he regretted it as soon as he said it. But he had said it, so he had to be good to his word. Once he had promised him any boon that he wanted, he was obligated, and he felt bad that he felt like, oh, it was a Homer Simpson moment. Oh. Is that? Shri is what? Who is Shri? Lakshmi, the goddess of fortune. So when Bhrigu kicked Lord Vishnu in the chest, Lord Vishnu responded by saying, from now on, the goddess of fortune, who he was sitting with there, will reside on my chest where you have kicked her. So that's the Shri Vatsa. It's a little mark on the chest of Vishnu. It's a little tuft of hair. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Okay. This is a very good question. And this chapter about Vishnu, these various pastimes are related to Vishnu one way or another. And the question often comes up. In fact, if you look in the Encyclopedia Britannica under Krishna, you'll find what is the eighth incarnation of Vishnu. So that is a common misunderstanding. Why? Because all the avatars come through Vishnu. Even at the beginning of the 10th canto, if you remember, when earth was in distress, all the gods went to Vishnu. And Vishnu said, don't worry, Krishna will be coming. So that apparently puts Vishnu in a superior position. And superficially, people understand it that way. But this chapter shows the answer to that question, which does come up. Why Krishna? Why not Vishnu? So it's very subtle, but they finally went to Vishnu to get the sons, and Vishnu said, yes, I took those sons to get you to come. So Lord Vishnu and Lord Krishna are speaking back and forth. Now, Andrea, the first canto, which you didn't get to hear, explains this relationship between Vishnu and Krishna. In the early section of Srimad Bhagavatam, the Vishnu incarnations are Krishna's expansions for the material world, basically. It's described that the spiritual sky is this place where it's always party night, and every word is a song, and every step is a dance, and time is conspicuous by its absence. So nobody ever sleeps. Why would you sleep if it's just all fun all the time? At the same time, everything comes from Krishna, so sleep also comes from Krishna. So that part of the spiritual sky where there's sleep, Krishna incarnates as Vishnu and lies down and goes to sleep. Pardon me? For some people, like Ankush, sleeping is also fun. Prabhupada said sleep is death, but that's... No. So, sleep is the that position in which there is stagnant non-activity, and it's antithetical to the spiritual world. But there are souls in the spiritual world, like us, who say, I would rather be the supreme myself and not bother with Krishna, not bother with God. So Krishna gives that freedom for us to choose to have that consciousness, that self-centered, I'm the center of the universe, enjoyment is meant for me. And they are qualified then to enter the material universe, which Vishnu creates in his sleep. So the whole foundation of the material world is ignorance and sleep. And Vishnu is there sleeping. As he inhales, as he exhales, all the universes are manifest, countless universes. When he inhales, they all come back in. So they're bhutva, bhutva, praliyate. They're constantly being expanded and then destroyed and created and destroyed. Just as he's breathing, just on and on and on. This universe, which seems so long to us, is just his one breath. That's right. Go ahead. Externally, internally. Well, there, that internal cleansing is a gradual process. So, if we are following the process of sadhana bhakti, that scientific process, acting as if we did love Krishna, even if we have not yet developed love of Krishna, then we're progressing. It's, in other words, it's yoga. It is self-control. That even if my consciousness is not proper, I'm going to do the proper thing. And this is all explained in the Bhagavad Gita, that by following the rules and regulations, then one develops a desire to love God. If it's best, if we love God, we wouldn't have condescending thoughts, we wouldn't have negative thoughts, we wouldn't be in an ego trip, we wouldn't be just doing a show. But we may not be able to help that. That may be the best we can do. And that's the dispensation. You see that in Kali Yuga, even if you are not pure inside, you can still become purified by following the process. You see, if that person doesn't really want to become purified, then Krishna will fulfill their desire. Olivia, you get the point? Krishna will fulfill the desire. If that person doesn't really want to be purified, I wish I could stop thinking this way, but I can't. So, but I wish I could, and Krishna, please help me. If we have that mentality, we cannot fail to be successful. But if our mentality is, well, I'll just fake it and get some other purpose out of this practice, then Krishna will also fulfill that desire. You see? He's very neutral. We have the freedom to desire what we want. So, it's fortunately, the other good thing is it's not our responsibility to evaluate whether somebody is sincere or not. Krishna will take care of that. Just like the example is given, is if a person's unclean but they're in the shower, then they may still be unclean but they're in the right position. So in course of time, if they stay in the shower, they will become clean. You see? Ourselves, yeah. It's really a matter of our desire. That's the line. If we are here for the purpose of getting purified, then we're, even if our thoughts are, or if our mind's uncooperative, you know, if our heart is in the right place, then the mind will eventually submit. There's a beautiful video online at dandavats.com called it's a mime. And there's two actors, and one is playing the mind and the other is playing the person. It's so funny. You've seen that? Yeah, so that's an excellent way to see. Krishna will fulfill your desire.